Hello, and welcome to Investigative Postcast, a podcast program from Investigative Post. I'm Jim Heaney, editor of Investigative Post, a nonprofit investigative reporting center based here in Buffalo. This week's episode features the keynote address given at our October 19th benefit dinner by Sarah Cohen. Sarah is a Pulitzer Prize winner who has worked at the New York Times and the Washington Post. She is now a professor of journalism at Arizona State University.
When I teach young reporters about how they do their work, I talk to them about, depending on the stage of your life, whether you are nursing a hangover and watching the Three Stooges on Saturday mornings is when you do a lot of your grunt work, or if you wait for the kids to go to bed and then you can do it then, one or the other. So thank you, Jim. I'm really nervous to be here at home. I didn't realize how nerve-wracking it would be to come to your hometown and give a talk. So forgive me if I'm a little bit nervous here. Jim asked me to give you a sense of how public affairs, journalism in general, and investigative reporting in particular are thriving or not in 2017. It's no secret that the news business is in a profound state of flux. That insecurity threatens the very existence of many local and statewide news organizations. It's put enormous stress on the ability to do in-depth reporting on matters of public importance, which is really what investigative reporting is about, often reporting on issues that people in power would prefer to keep secret. And I know that's going to sound a little bit familiar of some of the other words you heard earlier, but that is the fundamental idea of what we do in investigative reporting. The numbers are pretty staggering. This country has lost more than 300,000 local reporters in the last two decades. There's been a one-third reduction in some time slots of local evening news over the last 10 years. Hundreds of thousands of subscribers have walked away from previously powerhouse regional papers like the Miami Herald, the Philadelphia Inquirer, and even the Buffalo News. But at the same time, over the last year, we've seen a resurgence of investigative reporting, of serious investigative reporting on a new administration that really is quite openly hostile to accountability, both in its work as a government and in its private conflicts of interest. But those national stories, I might argue, have become entertainment pieces for people. They're really, the Trump bump in a lot of news organizations is really for the reality show. And that reality show is the daily back and forth of bickering and counteracting charges that just don't seem to end any day. So where are we really? I'm finishing up an eight-year run on the Board of Investigative Reporters and Editors, that association that Jim and that David K. Johnston also mentioned. That organization teaches young reporters and experienced reporters how to use records, data, and other raw materials to explore, explain, and investigate on their own. The group has grown from only 2,500 people at the height of the Great Recession to more than 5,000 now across more than 100 countries. More than one-fifth of its members are students and young graduates. I'm happy to claim two of them that I required to join IRE when they were my students, both Charlotte Keith and Daniela Porat here at iPost News. But that generation of reporters is finding investigative reporting, and we're really happy to see that happening. And most of those young reporters are not covering the White House and Congress. They're out covering their communities, just the way iPost News does, just the way the TV stations here do, just the way the Buffalo News does. And for me, the rewarding parts of investigative reporting have always been local stories. My first so-called investigation, I call it so-called because it was a little bit lame, but it was in 1993, and I think Jim might have forgotten that when he was in Orlando, I was at the Tampa Tribune and the St. Petersburg Times, where it may have been where we first crossed paths. We were the competition. Two of those papers still exist out of those three. But I was at the Tampa Tribune in 1993, and my first investigation helped return tens of thousands of dollars to fixed income retirees who'd been bilked by a really classic Ponzi scheme. The people eventually went to prison, but unfortunately not because of my reporting or because of the Ponzi scheme, but because they tried to blow up the judge's house. But that's another story. Visiting them in prison was a little bit scary. But my dream as a reporter was never to work for the Washington Post or the New York Times. I wanted to work for the Baltimore Sun. That's where I thought that you could make a difference. It was another once great regional paper that emphasized investigations and long-form writing, and I always loved Baltimore because it reminded me so much of Buffalo. And so I really wanted to go to Baltimore. Unfortunately, they refused to hire me, so I had to go to the Washington Post. I got lucky, but I didn't have to. I was concerned that going to the Washington Post would drag you into covering politics and the daily scrum of Washington, and I was lucky. Because again, at the Post, my most rewarding stories were about local and state news. DC is a little odd, given that it's both a city and a state, but we won a Pulitzer Prize for a story on the failure of the DC government to protect children, even after their problems had come to the attention of officials. That story began after a beat reporter covered a story about a toddler who was killed, and her sources started asking a chilling question: what happened to all the others? And we spent a year trying to scrape together documents and unpiece together the identities of more than 200 kids who had died after their cases had come to the attention of the authorities. Another story evolved when a team of reporters followed up on a simple question for a reader. He called blindly into the newsroom and said, "You know, there's this bureaucratic language at the bottom of my water bill, and I have no idea what it meant." After a little bit of digging, we discovered that what it meant was that Washington, D.C.'s water was tainted with lead. And we obtained leaked tests that showed 6,000 water tests around the city, and we were able to show people what neighborhoods had tainted water and which ones didn't, that the city was keeping secret. There was a story of a probate court that assigned a small group of lawyers to oversee frail people who needed a guardian but never checked on them. And I think that those of you who have done any of this kind of reporting, this is one of those moments that becomes the most rewarding as an investigative reporter. We walked the chief judge of DC through all of our results and all of the things that we had found, and he just didn't seem particularly concerned about it. Then the day the story ran, he called. He said, "It just took seeing it all put together on the front page of the newspaper and on the website before he really understood how devastating the conditions were for people." And he changed the way that the court operated that day. And that's the reason that most people love working on local stories, not because they love being a pit bull, although I think Jim probably does, but because they want to see government and agencies work the way they should. There are others all around the country who are doing this kind of work. There are in Reno, Nevada, just this year, the paper uncovered an alarming increase in inmate deaths after a new sheriff slashed costs and relaxed rules that were meant to keep them safe. In Florida, a local licensing board dismissed cases against contractors after secret meetings. And in Kansas City, a Boilermakers Union boss's salary went from $300,000 to $700,000 a year while he spent union dues on lavish dinners and sporting events. So if you're at this dinner, you know about the steady stream of important stories that have come out of iPost News and its television partner about policing, state spending, and the environment. So the good news then is that both news organizations and communities have come to a quasi conclusion, at least for now, that exclusive in-depth reporting on public affairs is what sets them apart from cat videos, quizzes, and social media campaigns that vie for our attention. That business model may not work in the long run. It never has. Public affairs reporting, the kind that makes us all better informed voters, that makes us better citizens, that reminds state legislatures and education boards that the public is watching them, is not a money-making proposition. Instead, it's always been subsidized at various times, sometimes by political parties in the early days of the US, by tycoons in the muckraking era, and by the crossword puzzle and comics in the 70s. Now there's even more warning signs for the role of investigative journalism and what many of us call accountability journalism in our democracy. Because our model of investigative reporting makes one overarching assumption. That is that people in government and at the top of local institutions don't wake up every day scheming to get rich, rip off their taxpayers, lie, cheat, or steal. That the vast majority of civil servants want to do, at the very least, do their jobs, and many want to do well for their communities. It assumes that mayors, governors, agency heads, and candidates have a sense of duty to their constituents, one that means that they're going to be honest brokers. Of course, politicians spin, evade, obstruct, and even sometimes lie. But when confronted with specific questions in the past, they have most often tried to answer them in good faith. They've sought to fix systemic problems that were brought to their attention, that were under their control. And they've taken the intrusion that reporters present to them as part of our national democratic system, that journalism is standing in for the public, sometimes well, sometimes not so well, so there is some obligation to answer. Unfortunately, the accelerating chaos is the only way I can think about it at the national level. The bickering, the palace intrigue, the quite open hostility to that grand bargain is starting to trickle down into states and local governments. And it's a dangerous phenomenon. It's one that says that no one has the right to question authorities, that asking an official a simple question, in the words of the White House press secretary just today, is disgusting, that no one, as the Roman poet said, is empowered to guard the guardians. So that hostility has already led to the assault of a reporter from The Guardian who asked a congressional candidate a question on his way out of a public forum. It's led to the arrest of a reporter who asked former Secretary Tom Price a question in a state house hallway. And it's leading to a whole generation of public officials to brush off any questions as improper, inappropriate, and maybe even unpatriotic. We no longer engage in an honest exchange of information. They slam the door and then get angry when reporters fail to take no for an answer. We're all familiar with the movie versions of reporters not taking no for an answer. Those of people of my age remember watching Woodward and Bernstein pay evening visits to officials and get doors slammed in their face and go to libraries and sift through library cards until they could prove tips. Younger moviegoers are familiar with Spotlight team that systematically uncovered longstanding abuses in the Catholic Church. As I was preparing this talk, I went back and looked at some speeches about investigative journalism, and one that caught my eye was from Chris Hitchens, the Vanity Fair reporter who was known for his, all I could call it, his longstanding righteous anger. His speech was to a group of reporters and editors that worked at alternative weeklies like the Village Voice or maybe The Public. In that speech, he mentioned a story that 20 years ago consumed the Clinton White House. It wasn't Monica Lewinsky. It was a series of 5 nuclear bomb tests conducted by India in response to missile testing by Pakistan. The test prompted sanctions and raised the specter of a new nuclear arms race. At the time, the Clinton administration said it was caught off guard and blamed the CIA in an intelligence failure. Everyone reported that. One reporter, Nora Bustani at the Washington Post, asked the question, was that true? It turned out in the weeks leading up to the test, the Pakistani prime minister had written to both the President Clinton and Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, warning of the tests and asking the US to intervene. The reporter confirmed that both agencies had received the warnings because, again, the government once asked specific questions, they were able to get specific answers. That when the officials agreed that they had received the letters and asked what they did with them, they said they sent them to the CIA for evaluation. One reporter, after dozens of news outlets had repeated the White House's claim. I expect that there will be one reporter left who can ask questions, and there will be one person in authority who will answer those questions for a long time, but there's no guarantee. So I'm doing my part by leaving the chaos of national news, by working with young reporters in Arizona to cover their state and reservations and the border. Others can help by reminding both public officials and even some reporters who seem to take glee in downfall of others that our purpose as journalists and our role is to make institutions and government work the way that they're supposed to. And finally, we can all celebrate, subscribe, and donate to a local news organization. They need your help, and we need their work. Thank you for your time, and enjoy the rest of the evening.
For Investigative Post, I'm Jim Heaney. Thanks for listening.